Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. This is one of two podcasts available to you today on the eve of a new Premier League season. We have our Arsenal-focused season preview out now as well. You can listen to me and Kaya Kainak from Football London talk about Arsenal's summer business, the expectations, the season ahead, the various challenges that we face, but are excited to do so. You can hear that right now. That's available in your podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. In this particular episode, I'm joined, as tradition dictates, by Ken Early from Second Captains to take a more broad look at the Premier League season ahead, football in general. And as ever with Ken, it kind of goes places, but in very enjoyable fashion. I hope you will agree. But just before we get to that, let me give you one last push in the direction of our Fantasy Football League, available to our Patreon members only. That is because we have got some incredible prizes to give away to you. Top prize is €1,000 in cash. Whoever comes in top gets €1,000 in cash, plus an Arsenal shirt. Second, €500 and an Arsenal shirt. Third place, €250 and an Arsenal shirt. And if you come in fourth, well, you get a fourth place trophy. What else would there be? Plus an Arsenal shirt. If you want to sign up, you've got to do that before 6:30 this evening GMT. That's 6:30 GMT. That is the cutoff point. And I am, of course, talking about Friday. If you're in before then, you can fight for those prizes. If you're not in, I'm afraid we can't make any exceptions. Don't say you weren't warned. You can sign up right now if you're not already a member on Patreon. Not only do you get the fantasy football, you get lots more extra content during the year. Preview podcasts, the 30 Waffle podcast, Poorly Drawn Month, Discord chat, loads and loads more for just over a fiver a month. You can do it at patreon.com/arsblog. That's patreon.com/arsblog. Right, let's get on with this particular show. And it is my pleasure to welcome from Second Captains, Ken Early. Hi, Ken.
Andrew, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How has your summer been?
Yeah, pretty good. Not too bad, actually. I was in Greece. Ireland played Greece there in June. So I decided to stay in Greece after that for a little while.
Okay.
And then came back and I was all set to go to the Women's World Cup. But I broke my ribs falling over in my kitchen. I know you think that, I know what you're thinking. But it wasn't like that. It was just an unfortunate accident. So I couldn't go to that, which was disappointing. Although I would have been back by now anyway. Mm. So that brings us up to speed.
Okay. And here we are on the cusp of a new season. It feels, I don't know if it's just me, I was away in the States following the Arsenal tour a little bit and everything else, but it does feel like the gap between the end of the season and the start of a new season is shorter and shorter every year.
Well, last season was just the longest season, it just went on forever. And there was Premier League games in the last week of May, I think. Mm. Champions League final wasn't until the 10th of June. Was it the 10th of June? Mm. And then you had the World Cup in the middle. Honestly, Ireland were playing Greece on the 16th of June. The 19th of June, I think, was the second Ireland game against Gibraltar. I think it's the latest game they've ever played. If you look at a calendar as running from August to May, tradition, or June, that's the latest game that Ireland have ever been involved in that wasn't actually in a tournament. In fact, they've been knocked out of some tournaments. They played the entire finals tournament before the 19th of June. And here they were playing a qualifier against Gibraltar. You're just please, somebody make this stop. Just make it stop. And it did stop, and it's been gone for a while. And I suppose we're we're ready to get it back. And now all the matches are going to be longer. So, you know, just in case you thought there maybe wasn't enough last time, there's going to be more.
There is going to be more. And, you know, when you say that about the international commitments of the players, because, you know, for some of them, they had a couple of weeks off and then they had to come back for international duty and then they get another bit of time off, you know, a week off, and then they've got to come back for the start of preseason. And we are going to discuss, you know, the new rules and obviously the fact that Premier League games are going to last even longer now. We saw some of that on Sunday in the Community Shield at Wembley. But, you know, I was looking at the statement that Rafael Varane put out during the week about the demands on players. And it's an ongoing discussion point, isn't it? The welfare of players and the demands that are put on players and, you know, the quality versus quantity aspect of things. Like, can you really get the best football if you're flogging players for basically 11 and a half months of the year and then, you know, that you give them a couple of weeks off? I mean, what did you think of his statement? Because I suppose it is in some ways on the players themselves or the players' unions maybe to come out and talk about the things that affect them. And look, there is this idea that, okay, you're really well-paid footballers, you play football for a living, you're very lucky, you know, you of course are machines because you earn a lot of money every week and you should be there to provide us entertainment. But the, you know, the reality is they are human beings and they are susceptible to physical fatigue and injury and all of those kinds of things. And it does feel a bit like the players are looking at these new guidelines and not particularly looking forward to what it's going to mean for them throughout the course of this season.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of things obviously to consider here. I mean, when I look at Varane's tweet, there's loads of responses, basically, you know, kind of along the lines of, if you can't stand the heat, you know, go and do some other job because you get paid a fortune. And, you know, some people have actually hard lives and all you do is whinge. But I mean, it's true. Like the way that this is going, it's just more. It's just, you know, the international tournaments expanding, you know, the sort of Nations League bullshit, the nonsense Champions League format that we're going to have, not this season, but next. It's just like generate more games, generate more content. And, you know, these guys are at the sort of sharp end of it. I mean, it's just, you know, I suppose at the end of it, it's a case of, on the one hand, players are paid so much because their talent is very rare, right? The skills are not a lot of people are good enough to do what they do. But at the same time, they are disposable. There's always more players coming along, you know? And how could players change this if they were serious that their working conditions had become intolerable, that the demands that were being heaped upon them were just way too much? What could they do? They could go on strike. And I haven't seen any sign of that. You know, I haven't ever sort of heard any hint of like, well, we're going to actually get organized and do something to stop this. And as long as they don't, then it's a case, okay, well, you know, here's the schedule. We expect you to turn up. And if you don't, we'll get someone else. So, I mean, I think it's terrible what's happening, but it's just all of these different institutions that should be, you know, about, like, in theory, have started off with something to do with sport. Well, not the Premier League. I mean, in France, the Premier League is literally just a money-making organ. It's like, how can we make more money out of this thing? But, you know, FIFA and UEFA should have some sense of responsibility towards the sport. You know, does it actually mean, I think they've kind of completely forgotten about that, like that this is actually sport and not just a way of making people watch television.
Sure. I mean,
you know what I mean? That's literally all they think of. You know, so they don't care about these players. I mean, Fran is whinging now, but no, don't worry, he'll be gone soon and we'll get someone else in, and, you know, they'll get broken down and exhausted and then we'll get someone else in. And that's just the way it is. And sport itself, I mean, sport is irrelevant now. I mean, there used to be this kind of sense of, I mean, I'd say, for instance, this, all this stuff that you, I don't know if you watched Jake Paul against Nate Diaz.
No.
I guess you probably didn't, right? But you probably heard that it was on, right? It turns out that it's more lucrative, or that it's better for YouTubers to have these like big title fights.
Right.
Can you hear my dog?
Yeah, that's fine. We love a dog on the podcast. It's fine.
Okay, sorry. I don't know what he's going nuts at down there. He's probably hears a car outside. But it turns out that some YouTuber dickhead can make more money from a prize fight, way more money from a prize fight than like an actual boxer who spends all their lives, honing their craft, and in theory becoming some kind of serious athlete who's going to take part in serious sporting contests, which are supposed to mean something. No, it turns out that that's just nonsense. That actually all we want is just people we recognize, famous people, going through bullshit, which is of zero sort of athletic or sporting merit. It's just pure narrative. It's just pure bullshit. And actually, I mean, the thing that amazes me about this is how can this, and I know I'm talking about something here, which isn't the Premier League, but like, it is incredible to me that like people will pay to watch this just nonsense where there's nothing at stake. Like there's nothing at stake, you know, in a traditional, prize fight, you've got two people whose life is boxing, what's when they go into the ring, what's on the line for them is their career. You know, if they win, then that has very different, ramifications for their career than if they lose. And their health, you know, their actual physical health is all there. This is all at stake. And in order to protect these very important, these sort of precious things, you have to be really good at what you're doing. These guys now, it's just pure nonsense. It doesn't matter what the outcome is. Like Nate Diaz lost the fight. It's not like Nate Diaz cared about that. Like he's just going to the bank. It's just such a shakedown. Like it's so transparently cynical. And I see that Jake Paul is now like mechanically, like, I mean, you can just see the clockwork has like called out Conor McGregor, you know, on Twitter, and is like, you know, sent a volley of abuse in the direction of Conor McGregor. And I wonder where that could be leading, you know. And but this is it. Apparently, this is what boxing is now. So, I mean, that's maybe I don't know. I mean, football is still some way off that. But in terms of the actual sport, like the sense of it as having something to do with like athletic excellence, like that is just so far from the minds of anybody who's in any of the authorities that are running the sport that, like, you know, you can't really be surprised. I mean, the only thing we, you know, that they're just introducing all these ridiculous rules and making the game worse. And from the player's point of view, pretty difficult to get through a season.
Sure. Well, okay. Well, look, thankfully you've brought us back around to those rules and the way that they're going to be implemented in the Premier League next season. I mean, the time-wasting one is obviously the one that's been in the spotlight more, and this sort of focus on ball in play and how much time is being played in every Premier League game. And the idea, I think what's funny about this is the idea that, well, now we're going to crack down on time-wasting, as if they have some mandate to do it that is new, that they didn't previously have. Yeah. But of course they did. Referees can book goalkeepers for time wasting whenever they want. They've been able to do that for as long as they want. One thing that I noticed, last season and the season before, the 6 second rule, and it is a rule, the 6 second rule about goalkeeper having the ball in their hands. Like, you've got goalkeepers routinely with the ball in their hands between 20 and 30 seconds. And referees and officials have not done anything about it. And now we're going to go into a new season where, probably because of the way this stuff is being communicated or not being communicated, like, you know, Community Shield the other day, like, I know there are a lot of Arsenal fans in the stadium who had no idea about this new rule that when a player goes off, they've got to wait 30 seconds to come back on. They're all going crazy because Odegaard wasn't being let back on the pitch, but they had no idea that this is, you know, one of the new sort of guidelines that's in there. I mean, do you think this is going to make football better, or people just more angry about officiating? Because I have a feeling it's going to be the latter more than the former.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing, it's like when Father Ted tries to fix the car. Remember when he's got like a dent in the car and he says, "Oh, just takes the hammer and I'll just fix it." And then, you know, that's what that's what it reminds me of, this whole process of trying to change the rules to get what? I don't know, because like, I mean, now it's all about, oh, we want fast, continuous action. You know, we want 60 minutes of a ball and play, you know, it has to be, you know, the fans are being shortchanged, right? But 5 minutes ago it was, we need accurate refereeing, you know, and so what's happened with this, we need to bring in technology. We need to bring in video reviews in order to make sure that we always get the right decisions. And so, we do that, and what happens? You just get loads of pauses in the game, which like break the rhythm of the game. Mm. And you know, everyone is standing around, and it's particularly shit if you're actually in the stadium. And you know, it's like, oh, you know, and at the end, they still get loads of decisions wrong. Okay, but that was sort of yesterday. So what are we complaining about now? Oh, there are too many pauses in the game. The rhythm of the game isn't what it was. Time is slipping away. You know, we also had to bring in the five substitutes. Mm. The five substitutes is a response to, I guess, the point of view of Varane, where he's saying that, we're being asked to do too much. I mean, Jurgen Klopp was probably the most vocal person demanding it in the Premier League. But that also introduces breaks in play, which weren't there before. Yeah. And, you know, this is like, aspects of disruption to the rhythm of a game. And you can change, obviously, far more players in the game. It's like half the outfield players are often not going to finish the game. So you've got these things which have brought in a lot of disruptive events to the rhythm of the game. And now it's suddenly like, where's the rhythm of the game gone? You know, let's play and play and play. You know, like,
yeah.
This is like, what if you've got to get a train or something? You know, the, obviously nobody will have kind of considered that. Like, I mean, what this match has gone on sort of 20 minutes longer than like the previous season's match. You know, that's going to happen like lots of times this season. So like, you know, is that like who really wants this? Like, I mean, the players don't want it. The referees, according to Kevin De Bruyne, who was talking about it, you know, don't want it. I don't know who wants it. I guess it's more stuff to put on TV.
Yeah, maybe you get another ad break in there because you've got a longer program, or you can schedule a longer program. I mean, I'm looking at some of the other bits and bobs that are going on, and you know, leniency on physical challenges is another guideline on the pitch. As an attempt to allow the game to flow better and reduce stoppages, a higher threshold will be applied to contact between players, meaning there should be fewer free kicks awarded for incidents which last season might well have been penalized for being overly physical. And this is another
amazing
one.
You know, you saw Rodri in the Community Shield.
Yeah, of course I saw him. It was like, I don't, if you've got inconsistency with the application of the rules within 90 minutes from one referee, how is that going to play out over the course of a season where you've got different referees who will decide what a level of contact is that is merits a free kick, etc., etc.? And this is a bit like the whole let it flow thing, you know? Yeah. You know, there was a fear, I think, with the let it flow thing that somebody might get badly injured because players were going, okay, I can have a right go here because I'm being allowed to flow. The game is being allowed to flow, so I can get stuck in. And these are kind of these sort of abstract guidelines rather than absolute rules, which of course are open to interpretation. And the subjective nature of physical contact, of refereeing, and all the rest of it just strikes me as like, this is going to be, we're going to see a lot of really bad red cards in the opening part of the season that you will not see in the second part of the season, because then somebody will say, well, this is bullshit. You know, we've too many games where it's 10 against 11 or 9 against 11 or 9 against 10. And that's not what people are paying for either.
Yeah. You know, it's the kind of let it flow thing is just, oh my God. Like, why incentivize fouls? Like, that's what it does.
Mm.
Basically says, you'll probably get away with this foul, so foul more. You know what I mean? It's so obvious that that's the outcome. You get the opposite outcome to the one that you want. They also are insisting that, like, players won't be allowed to disrespect the referee anymore.
Yeah.
You know? We've had it. They're the only rule. This is the only rule that we're actually going to enforce now. Automatic bookings if you know, say boo to the referee. So it's Varane actually mentioned that in his post, which was, I said post there, his tweet.
Let's stay old school here.
longer games, more intensity and less emotions to be shown by the players. You know what I mean? So you're going to be out there for like 110, 115 minutes. People are going to be allowed kick you in the back or like drag you to the ground as you are breaking away on a counterattack. But if you get up and show annoyance at that point, then you'll get booked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's just, the whole thing is, it's just so stupid.
I mean,
like everything about it, it just reeks of stupidity. The rules are there. Just enforce the rules. Like, you know, there seems to have been quite a lot of these changes just over the last few years, you know, from VAR and the subs to this. And I'm kind of like, I know that it's reactionary at a certain, or it's you think of this person is old and fears change. You know, he doesn't understand anything anymore and he fears change and thinks, let's go back to the way things were. But it is a fact, I think, that, you know, football did have a pretty good run, you know, without too many of these sorts of changes being made. You know, I know that the 1990 World Cup, after that, they did bring in changes. You know, the back pass rule is the biggest one. And that this did, I think, improve the game. You know, like, let's not tackle people from behind anymore.
Yeah.
And let's not let a goalkeeper to pick up back passes. And these were positive changes. But I don't really think that the game that sort of proceeds to unfold for the next 30 years was really in need of all of this like sort of surgery that's being done to it now. You know, it just seems like this works. Like, the best football any of us have probably seen, you know, is probably the kind of Barcelona, Real Madrid, you know, Messi, Ronaldo era. I mean, that was kind of like, wow, you know, that, yeah. Certainly at the time it was like, this is we've never seen the like of this before, you know? And looking back, I think it still looks pretty good. That was like an intensely policed game. You know what I mean? In terms of Spanish referees will give free kicks for anything, you know, but like the fact is that actually encourages fast technical play more than, you know, just boot him. You know, it's fine. Get up, you know, this guy is on the ground whinging, bug that guy. You know what I mean? Like, this is just mindless. Like, it's just so, to my eyes, obviously stupid. And yet here we are.
But I mean, would you accept the idea that referees in general, you know, that football can improve in the way that players and managers interact with referees as opposed to some other sports? I know football is very different. It's almost unique in that regard. So perhaps some efforts to cut out very obvious shows of dissent. You know, we saw Partey booked in the Community Shield. We saw Alvarez booked in the Community Shield, not for booting the ball away, but for just sort of nudging the ball away when a free kick was given. And that now is an immediate yellow card. And of course, you have the idea now that managers... there's new rules for managers or people on the sidelines in terms of, you know, what you're allowed to do in your technical area, not coming out of your technical area. That feels like the Richard Keys rule that's come into play. And obviously, you know, as an Arsenal fan, watching Mikel Arteta on the sideline is quite amusing. I'm sure, you know, fans of other clubs don't dig it quite as much. But, you know, he has a way of operating on the sidelines, which, you know, let's face it, isn't unique, because Jurgen Klopp has done it and Jose Mourinho has done it, and pretty much every manager who gets invested in the emotion of a game, you know, gets a bit carried away because there's so much at stake in terms of their jobs and points and league table and all the rest of it. I mean, how do you balance that idea that, okay, referees should be respected because it trickles down into the way referees are treated at grassroots level and all that kind of stuff, versus, you know, the reality of, you know, what these guys are trying to produce and the stakes in which they are trying to do that?
Yeah, I mean, the point about managers is interesting. I mean, obviously, managers should not do this kind of stuff. Like, I remember Klopp against... was it Tottenham last season, where Liverpool scored at the last minute, having led a 3-0 lead, get back to 3-3, and he ran over to get in the face of whoever the fourth official was, I can't remember, and like actually pull his hamstring as he did it, because you know, as he was lurching over. And that was ridiculous. You know what I mean?
But it was funny.
It was funny, but like I think that was a case where people were laughing at Klopp rather than with him. But you know, I mean, and we've seen this kind of, they're saying you can't go on the field anymore to shout at the referee. And of course, like, you shouldn't do that. But like, also consider what happens to managers who just sit there calmly. You know, the fans all start screaming that their manager is a cooked loser. Like, you know, Louis van Gaal. Remember Louis van Gaal was the Man United manager? He would sit there. He had like this little leather valise where he had some papers, and he put that on his lap, and he would sit there and like watch the game. And you know, at the end, there was one time when he jumped up and he threw himself to the ground. Yeah, to show what a, you know, that was a kind of a rare show of dissent. It was probably, you know, this was a celebrated moment by the fans, because the fans apparently want the manager to run around and to perform, you know, like a Conte or. People like this, you know, that's it's showmanship, like Klopp does, you know. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he does is more positive. Like, there is a nasty sort of edge to that. But the thing is that if you don't do that, then everyone's like, this guy's a loser. You know, he just sits there. He's so passive, you know. So what are you supposed to do? Like, I mean, obviously the manager is going to be more concerned about what his own supporters think about him than what the referee thinks about him. You know, and actually some of them do believe that certain referees have got grudges against. I mean, again, Klopp, which referee was it he was singling out? It was the guy.
Tierney, is it Paul Tierney?
Yeah, Paul Tierney, yeah. You know, he genuinely believes that Paul Tierney is involved in some kind of conspiracy against him. I don't know if there are other people involved, but it's just a one-man vendetta that Paul Tierney is having against Jurgen Klopp. But like, I mean, he genuinely believes this, you know. So it's difficult. I mean, you know, to imagine yourself in that position where you feel you're. I mean, obviously, you want to win. For you know, you're deeply invested in your team and its chances, and you're a pretty kind of a wound up kind of person anyway, because that's why you're a football manager. And then you've got like 40 or 50,000 people screaming and sicking you onto the referee. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's, I think people at some point are just sort of channeling all, it's difficult to expect them to, you know, to at all points observe the kind of rules of decorum. I mean, part of it is like, it's part of the problem that you know, there's always a camera on them, so you can see every little behavioral dysfunction, you know what I mean? You can see it all, but you also have to perform all the time. Like, it's kind of immensely stressful, you know. Like, another way, say during the Women's World Cup there, a thing started to develop about some of the American women aren't singing the national anthem, you know what I mean? Like, it's an example of a kind of a detail which would not have been noticed before, really. You know what I mean? Maybe it's not the best example, but like, there's just, everything is noticed now, and small details are magnified and sort of amplified.
Yeah.
And that also creates the feeling that you are actually, the whole thing kind of has to become a performance, including like what a manager is doing on the sideline. Previous generations of managers were kind of just talking to the people who were right there in front of them. You know what I mean? Whereas now they're kind of performing for the entire worldwide audience, and they know they're being judged on how they behave in these moments. And actually the fact is that, that being good, you know, in the sense of obediently following the guidelines of respect and how to deal with, you know, refereeing setbacks, let's say, you know, behaving in the sort of cool-headed manner of sportsmanship, doesn't go down well with football fans. They actually want to see you engaging in sort of wrestling type behavior. You know, they want to see you taking it to the officials, fighting for the club, and like, it's a difficult situation these guys are in.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, what happens and how it happens. You know, I don't know if I believe this or not, but Gary Neville, you know, talked about how apparently Mikel Arteta was, you know, cited as one of the reasons why they're bringing in these new rules ahead of the new season. So,
I mean, what is it Arteta supposed to have done? Like, I mean, I watched like all of Arsenal last season, and I mean, it's mainly just a kind of a hobby horse of Richard Keys that I'm sort of aware of this, you know what I mean? And he's got this whole like obsession with Arteta in the technical area.
He comes out of his technical area.
He's just one blogger/broadcaster. I mean, come on, like, he's not that powerful.
Well, he's put enough spotlight on it. Maybe it's just the sort of levels of Arsenal fans roasting him every time he said anything. Arsenal Twitter doing its thing that has become that. I mean, I'm not sure I believe Gary Neville in the sense that, you know, this one guy has changed everything about the way referees and coaches are expected to behave in the technical area. But we'll see how it plays out. Let's sort of move on to talk a bit of football and talk about some of the teams that are going to be front and center in this Premier League. Manchester City, treble winners. I mean, is their motivation the fact that no team has won four in a row in England? Is that something that they can do or overcome? I mean, I watched Community Shield on Sunday. Someone said to me, Lewis Ambrose, who does some stuff for the site, you know, the first sort of 20 minutes of that game was basically a real life equivalent of that Simpsons bit about soccer.
Mexico versus Portugal.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah.
I mean, I find their football hard to connect with, you know, in general. And
it was mind numbing. It was absolutely mind numbing. But, you know, you can't, I don't think, put all the blame on City for that. It was the combination of the approach City decided to take and the approach Arsenal decided to take in response to that.
Yeah.
If Arsenal had gone running after the ball and had, had done basically what City wanted them to do, which is come running for the ball and get passed around, and so suddenly City are in with a 3-on-3, then it probably would have been more exciting, certainly for Man City fans.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what we did last season, though. So I think there's an element of lesson learned there from an Arsenal perspective in that, like, they know City can play more directly and go over the press. So it was a case of, well, look, fool me once, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, they're going to... I mean, it was interesting. Like, it was the real kind of De Zerbi stuff from City, right? You know, this whole... Well, let's bait the press and let's get them to, let's, you know, before we don't do anything until they basically come chasing the ball practically up to our penalty area. And then we will move forward quickly and it'll be like a counterattack. And you're like, yeah, okay. Are you going to do this in every game this season? Because there's going to be a lot of really boring opening half hours in Man City games if that's the case. I mean, it's one thing if City are leading to do that. You know, then you're like, oh God, you know, imagine how difficult the situation is now once Man City have got the first goal against you. But I think when playing City, a lot of Premier League teams are going to be quite happy to, they, you know, 0-0 would be great. 0-0 is a great result against City as far as almost every team in the league is concerned. I mean, if you were offered 2 0-0s for Arsenal against Man City in the league now, you'd probably say, yeah, you know, I mean, that's, at least we're not giving up any points to them.
Sure.
So I think City will probably have to be a bit more proactive. I mean, it's fine to do that when you're leading, but like against any team would be crazy to do what they wanted to play into their hands when they're doing this. But you know, at some point you have to also score yourself if you're City. So
yeah,
I don't know. Like, I mean, it's like you on one level you have to kind of admire Guardiola in terms of his determination to always kind of keep evolving, keep changing. You know, we've got to try it. We can't do this. We can't come back and just do the same thing. We've got to keep moving forward. And, you know, that worked really well, certainly last season when he changed the whole thing halfway through the season and they, you know, end up winning the treble. And you have to admire the way he's not intimidated at all by the public or the public reaction. You know, like his hero, that the guy in the chef, Ferran Adria, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like this, I'm pushing back the frontiers of gastronomy so far at El Bougie that it actually cost me a fortune to run and I can't actually afford to keep the restaurant open anymore. So I have to close the restaurant. you know, people are queuing up or there's like a 3-year waiting list to eat at this place, but I'm sorry, I have to close it down. I'm
sorry. No mushroom foam for you.
Yeah. So, you know, he doesn't care. Like, I honestly was watching that first half hour and going, this is absurd. Like, I can't believe, what are we all here watching this for? Can someone text me when something happens in this game? You know, you're like looking at the City press baiting machine and you're like, this is kind of cool. Is it going to do anything? You know, and eventually the chaos that Guardiola was always trying to keep at bay just did creep into the game and things started to happen. And And there was a deflection and all the best laid plans ended up with Arsenal winning the Community Shield. So I don't know. Like, I mean, it's always, it's interesting on a kind of a, in a theoretical way, what City are doing, but like, you know, it's not, you know, do I want to watch Ederson and Diaz and Stones pass the ball to each other for half an hour?
No.
Like, no, no. No. So, yeah, it's going to be, I wonder if they're going to be able to stick to that throughout the season.
No, I mean, I guess a bit will depend as well on what else they do in the transfer market, because they've lost, you know, a couple of exciting players in Gundogan, who was very influential, Mahrez, you know, a great option from the right. And they have brought in Kovacic and another top quality center half in Gvardiol. You know, his collection of very, very good central defenders. It's a bit like George Graham back in the day. He just seems to collect central defenders right now. But they are after, seems like they're after Lucas Paqueta from West Ham. West Ham, as we know, not the easiest to deal with in the transfer market this summer.
Mm. Well, unless they're trying to buy your players. Buying their players may be a bit more difficult. But yeah, I mean, I think Gundogan is, I mean, they're going to miss him. Like, he was huge for them in the last second half of the season.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Kovacic, I think, is a really good player, but he's not going to score goals like Gundogan did. At least he never has done. You know, maybe in this team we'll start to see that side of his game, you know, which he's kept hidden from us until now. I mean, I think he can definitely play, you know, Man City football. Like, he's technically really good. So on that level, it's kind of like for like. But something about the way Gundogan was coming up with big goals for them, you know, these things, like, that's hard to replace. Mahrez is one of their top goal and assists contributors. Even last season, I think he was third in the squad. Maybe he was second.
Mm.
You know, he was, I think, really good, although ultimately someone who Guardiola could take or leave, I think, maybe a bit too much of an individualist for Guardiola. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Alvarez this season, because he looks really brilliant to me. And kind of, you know, this I assume, is part of the logic of letting Mahrez go, is that, well, this guy, we have to find a way for this guy into the team somehow. What his best position is, I'm not really sure, but he is the kind of player who I think can play in a few different attacking positions. His main position where he probably likes to play, he's obviously not going to play, because as long as Erling Haaland is fit, he's going to play. And it's for, you know, when it's still just very difficult. Like, if Haaland does what he did last season again, like, how can anyone stop these guys from winning the league? I mean, it's a fact that no one's won the league four times in a row. It has something to do with, you know, once you've won it three times, it's hard to make the same effort.
Yeah.
You know? And that's really, everyone's just going to be looking at City hoping
that that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, how can it not be the case to some extent? You know, all right, lads, we're going to become the first team to win four in a row. It's like, ugh, who cares at that point? You know what I mean? No one, that's not a motivation. Really, you know, it's like, no one's ever won four in a row before. Let's be the first. We'll go down in history.
I mean, do you think it's important for the Premier League that somebody else wins it next season? Because what if City won now? 5 out of 6? I mean, is it actually important for the Premier League that another club, and obviously, you know, I hope it's Arsenal, wins the Premier League? Because, you know, there is this sort of acceptance of what City are, how they are, what they are. You know, the sort of combination of brilliance, because you can't ignore the fact that Guardiola is a brilliant coach, but also, you know, all the stuff behind the scenes and the finances and the 115 charges and all the rest of it, all the stuff that everybody knows about the way this Man City project has been constructed, that is sort of, there's an artifice to it, you know. But well, the Premier League,
like, it's repulsive, you know. The project is not, I don't think it has appeal to anybody apart from
Man City fans.
If you're a Man City fan, even, I don't know, like, I mean, I was about to say, even if you're a Man City fan, how can you really like this? But I suppose you just kind of compartmentalize a little bit. But, like, it is just nonsense. I think absolutely it is, because the Man City are not really, I mean, they're not attractive champions at all from the point of the view of the Premier League. This is just not, this is not a sporting story. Man City's dominance of the Premier League is like a kind of an encapsulation of what's wrong with football. You know, it's like it, on a kind of a basic level, I think most people who look at it can kind of sense that, like, you know, a wealthy emirate decides to buy a football team and like dominate a league for years and years through kind of brute financial firepower is like, has got nothing to do with sport. You know, it's just like, and then you've got all the charges. Oh, you've broken this rule, you've broken that rule. Like, and yet you continue to go on anyway. Like, this is just like, really, is this is what we're doing now. Like, this is, you know, there's something about it which is, I mean, I don't think from the point of view of the Premier League this is good at all. I mean, the Premier League, okay, doesn't seem to have any problems yet in terms of its popularity, its appeal. You know, it's not as though people are like cancelling subscriptions in droves because they're sick of Man City. That's not the case. So from that point of view, maybe it doesn't matter to them. But like, I feel as though this is kind of hollowing something out. Like, this is kind of like, oh.
I mean, there's an indifference, isn't there, to Manchester City, in the sense that, like, you can recognize that it's a very good team, but just not give a fuck about what they do because of everything else. And I think the Premier League's answer in some ways to what Manchester City have done, or what the Manchester City project has been, is to allow others. You know, and we can see what's going on at Newcastle. Whether they ever get to that level, I'm not 100% sure. But they have even greater finances or financial debt than Manchester City, and we don't know quite what's going to happen with Manchester United yet as well, in terms of their ownership. So, I mean, look, it all goes back to Abramovich. It all goes back to what happened at Chelsea, and the stable door. You can't close it when all the fucking horses have bolted and they're way down the line now. But you know, from a sporting perspective, whatever is left in the Premier League, I think it needs somebody else to win it. I think it needs to demonstrate that there is, despite the fact that there's competition, right? You can say it's a strong league and there is competition and there is, the rivals, and there are good games and very good teams, and they can all take points off each other, and the technical level is extremely high. When one team wins 5 out of 6, you know, you're in the sort of realms of the Bundesliga, of Liga, et cetera, and they carry on and everything else. But, it's a new thing for English football, I think. Even when you've had teams like United, when you've had teams like Liverpool who have dominated for periods, it was not to this extent. No, they didn't.
97 and 2001.
Yeah, they won 99, 2000, 2001, didn't they? And then Arsenal were either side of that, you know? So even then, when United were, you know, the best team, there was a dominant.
There's no comparison between Manchester United when what they did and what City are doing. There's no comparison.
No, I'm not comparing it. I'm just saying that when United were as good as they were, there was a genuine rival as well.
Everybody cared about it.
Yeah,
like, you know, that team was hated by everybody else, more or less. Everybody else, like, everyone was interested in their games. You know, everyone was interested in them losing. But you know, when they won, it was like, well, you know, this team's pretty good. Like, I mean, it's kind of amazing. You know, all these young players. It can't be compared to this Man City thing, which is like this kind of, you know, like a, it's like
manufactured.
Manufactured sort of like a, it's like a sort of spaceship that's hovering over the rest of the Premier League. You know what I mean? Like, it's not on the same level. It's like, it didn't feel like they're playing by the same rules. I mean, they're obviously accused of breaking rules, but it kind of feels like, yeah, you know, it's just sort of they're sort of on easy mode here. They're not really face the same kind of problems as other teams have got. And the terrible thing about it is now that you've got this, now that they're just doing this, everyone else wants to do it too. I mean, obviously there ultimately is a finite number of of Emirates who want to do soft power projects in quite this this type of way. I mean, I suppose that maybe someone will tap a new seam, you know, insane tech billionaires or something. But, you know, even then, like, I mean, we talk a lot, some people say you shouldn't, about the intersection between politics and football. People have been doing this for a long time, but previously, when people talked about this, they were always talking about politics as being something that had kind of emanated from the fans or like the culture surrounding the game, and you know how that kind of played into things that were happening in those countries. What we have now is international politics, like international politics from the Persian Gulf, which appeared to be deciding outcomes in European football, you know. And we've got like Newcastle owned by Saudi Arabia because it seems that like Mohammed bin Salman was kind of going, why are these guys in Qatar and Abu Dhabi like getting all the credit? Like, you know, we're better than them. Like, I mean, why are we not getting some of that action? You know what I mean? And then, and now they're in, and because this is like, because nobody can compete, or nobody has ultimately been able to compete with what Man City are doing, you've got the only club actually over the last 5 or 6 years that has put up any resistance to City in terms of, you know, running them close for titles is Liverpool. And look what's happening there at the moment. You've got like a huge number of Liverpool fans saying, oh, you know, this is a joke. Like, I mean, they don't have the money to, FSG doesn't have the money to compete at the top of the Premier League. We need to get in, you know, we need to get in proper owners. And by which they obviously mean somebody like the people who own Manchester City or the people who own Newcastle United. So it's a case of, but like, consider how insane that statement is, right? They don't have the money to compete at the top of the Premier League anymore. We're talking here about Liverpool Football Club.
Sure.
Now, right? I mean, this has been one of the top earning clubs in the world of football for, I mean, since they started doing this, you know, Deloitte stuff 25 years ago. But if you look at the last 5 or 6 years, like the Klopp era, they've been kind of in the top three. You know, they've been right up at the very top of these turnover lists, and they're apparently they can't afford to compete. You know,
isn't that just a consequence?
This is not good.
No, it's not good. I mean, that is a consequence, though, of the ownership that has been allowed to run Manchester City and is now being allowed to run Newcastle. That when the bar gets pushed higher and higher and higher, you know, the perception that the playing field is completely unlevel, you know, will be, you know, widespread, I think. And you can understand why, because, you know, Manchester City have won 5 out of 6. And, you know, who knows? I'm not saying it will happen. Like, you have Newcastle win 5 out of 6 at some point. It'd just be like, well, what's the fucking point? We might as well give up here.
Cans. That's what they'd say. Cans. Like, I mean, the reaction to the whole Newcastle takeover was just, you know, the sort of the unbridled joy of the Newcastle fans. Wow, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. You know what I mean? It's like,
but I mean, they were suffering with Mike Ashley. So it's literally anybody else. It doesn't matter who comes along with a bag of money is going to be welcomed in. You know, that's.
This isn't really Newcastle, though. Like, I mean, this is.
But what is Newcastle? What's any?
This is Saudi. This is sort of Saudi Arabia now.
Sure,
you're Saudi. You're public Saudi Arabian investment fans fund now. You're part of a. You're the kind of the background characters in a billboard celebrating Mohammed bin Salman's Vision 2030. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. You've been hired as extras in like a Saudi propaganda movie.
But isn't one of the great abilities of football fans the sort of cognitive dissonance that goes with, you know, when you're at this level of the game, whether it's, you know, whoever owns you, there are going to be question marks over, you know, where they got their money, their politics, you know, all of those things, sponsors, you've got to be able to put it to one side, because ultimately your love and your passion is for the football team. And of course, this is why all of this happens. This is why it's easy for those for people, you know, to come in and to co-opt all the good things about football, because they, you know, it's sort of unshakable for the most part. There are people who will say, that's it, I'm walking away, I can't take this anymore. But, you know, for the most part, people just want to watch their football team because that's what they've done all their lives.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder how unshakable it is. I mean, baseball used to be considered unshakable, and Like, it's just old people who watch that now.
Yeah.
So, you know, the crowds at Premier League games are getting older and older and older. I mean, this is something I'm sure we've spoken about this before. But like, the average age is going up like nearly a year every year. You know, it's like, so, you know, maybe that's just going to keep going. You know, maybe it is. Maybe it will just keep going forever. But, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean, this, the Premier League, is it really kind of a sustainable thing? I mean, at the moment, it's sort of really on top, sort of lording it over all the other leagues. But I don't know. I mean, are you really convinced that by the foundations of this? I mean, I know that it goes back a long way.
Sure.
But what it is now just seems to bear very little relation to what it actually was in the past. It's just sort of, it's just branding. It's just wallpaper.
Well, I mean, I think that's also a consequence or a reflection of the world that we live in and the way the media has changed and those things as well. I mean, the talk of the Premier League bubble bursting has been going on for a long time and it doesn't seem to ever burst. I mean, it might do at some point, but as long as the best players are here, as long as all the money is in the Premier League, you know, I think it will continue to expand.
A question, you know, I mean, What happens if Saudi Arabia really is serious about it? For Newcastle, it turns out they're like, they've been downgraded. They're actually only a supporting character, a bit part player in the propaganda exercise. The main thrust of which is actually going to happen in the Saudi Pro League. You know, I mean, because I have to say, what's been happening there really is, you know, has taken me by surprise. With Ruben Neves went, you know, you're like, wow, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's not quite...
it's not Ronaldo.
No, know? Exactly.
Ronaldo is like, oh, come on, I'm 38 or whatever. They're offering me like 200 million.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, of course you're going to take it, right? I mean,
like, of course. I mean, it is sort of, in some ways, an existential threat to the Premier League doing exactly what the Premier League did to all the other leagues, just not quite as blatantly, if you like. It sort of grew a little bit more, I don't want to use the word organically, sound like some kind of wanker, but you know what I mean, it did take time to establish itself as the number one destination. But
yeah, and also the Premier League was building on an already existing, you know, century old culture.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of more than a century of high-level competitive football,
yeah,
which had at various times been considered as the best in the world, you know, before the war, at times after the war. You know, there was like, this is the world's longest continuous football culture. So when the Premier League also added all of this Murdoch money, you know, it was obviously... It wasn't just the money that made English football a big thing. It already was big. Whereas this Saudi football, Saudi domestic football has never really been a thing anyone outside Saudi Arabia is interested in. But if they've got more money than everybody else, and if they're paying higher wages than everybody else, then gravity, it's like a law of gravity. It's that's where the players are going to go.
Yeah.
And it maybe won't take as long as we think. The only question is how committed they are to actually doing this. That's the only limiting factor.
No, I agree. And we've seen throughout this summer players go there who you would not have expected to go there. I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of that. I do want to talk a little bit more about some of the individual teams. But I want to ask you first about Arsenal and what you think about Arsenal's summer and the way Arsenal have responded to the disappointment of finishing last season with a bit of a wobble, and Manchester City overtook us and won the title, obviously. But it was a season of genuine progress from an Arsenal perspective. And, you know, I think a couple of seasons in a row now have ended with perhaps salutary lessons in terms of what you need to do when it comes to building your squad. And Arsenal, you know, for all the talk of Manchester City's money, have gone out and spent £100 million on Declan Rice and £65 million on Kai Havertz and another, you know, £35-40 million on Jurrien Timber. And David Raya is coming in from Brentford for £30 million. So Arsenal are doing as much as they can possibly do to try and stay competitive against City and all the other teams in this league.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, I mean, Arsenal seem to be in a really good place. Like, I think Havertz is a very good player, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he was phenomenal in his last season in the Bundesliga, and Chelsea bought him because at the time, the clubs who might usually buy him, I mean, the club that would usually buy this player is obviously Bayern Munich, because of COVID, was like, we suddenly don't really know how much money we've got.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of like, oh, and Chelsea just opportunistically having kind of pools of cash because of Abramovich, went in and bought him. They did the same thing with Werner, who you remember was, he was supposed to join Liverpool at that time. And then they were like, oh, hang on, we actually did their usual thing. we're not sure if we have any money. And Chelsea were like, well, we'll take him. You think he's good? You've got a pretty good hit rate in the transfer market. Of course, he seemed to be one of those guys they were signing in the late Liverpool period when all the signings go wrong instead of the previous run they had. But so he never – Chelsea basically bought him without a plan as to where they were going to play him. It was purely because they recognized this guy is a top talent who is suddenly available, who would not usually consider actually joining us, and we can get him. So
sure.
they did it, and it never really happened for him at Chelsea. But I think that has to do with a lot of, you know, I mean, the period that he was there obviously was chaotic. I mean, it never really happened for him. Does include scoring the winning goal in the Champions League final.
Yes.
you know, which was kind of, again, just such a weird, like nobody thought Chelsea were the best team in Europe that season, but like it was one of those Champions League campaigns that works out in a kind of a weird way. So obviously this is like, this is as good as it gets trophy-wise, but performance-wise, football-wise, I don't think he ever really showed what he's really capable of. And I always thought that he would be better playing as... Now, I know this is the thing that Chelsea fans say. Oh, yeah, he's better when he plays here, or he needs to play in a certain role. You know, he needs to have a player, a right-footed player outside and a left-footed player. But, you know, all this kind of stuff. The kind of thing that used to be said about Paul Pogba. You know, well, he needs to play on the left of a three, or, you know, he needs, this is when he plays his best stuff. You know, and you're like, well, hang on. It's apparently you envisage a role of such specificity, like it's maybe only happened on a couple of football pitches ever in history, you know, that exactly the right role for this player.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the kind of question mark about Havertz. But I think basically he is an attacking midfielder who, I think he has got physical presence as well. So I could see Havertz, Rice, and Odegaard being a pretty strong three in midfield. You know, with Rice as the anchoring player and Odegaard as the other two. Or, you know, he may be thinking of a kind of a more box-shaped midfield, but Havertz could play in that as well. I think that he's got this potential, although it's now up to him to actually prove it, because while you can look at Chelsea and say, well, it was kind of chaos, there was no plan, there was coaches changing the whole time, the team was changing the whole time, and we never really were able to nail down a proper role or what I was supposed to do in the team, and most of the time he was playing as a false nine, which I don't think is his best position, then again, and so he's at Arsenal, which is a club which you know, certainly has got clarity at the moment. I mean, a very strong manager with a very clear idea of what he's doing, a fairly stable squad, you know, a kind of a clear purpose. That's all that's all there. So it's all set up for him. Of course, what happens in his first game, Gabriel Jesus isn't there, so he has to play false nine. So I mean, misses chances.
Yeah.
So I still think that he's a good signing, though. And then obviously Rice is the main signing. I mean, Rice is like, I mean.
Does it say something? I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, about somebody needing to win the Premier League rather than Manchester City. Is there anything to be read into the fact that Declan Rice chose Arsenal over Manchester City? Now, I do think Arsenal put in a lot more groundwork. I think City came in much later, but of course, the temptation to join a club where you're pretty much guaranteed a shitload of medals and trophies, you know, has to be something to consider. Nevertheless, you know, he chose Arsenal. Is there something to be said for the perception of what Arsenal are doing right now, or where Arsenal could go under this manager and in this current project versus Manchester City? Or is it just like, you know, it's easier to go to Arsenal because, you know, they've sold me on a really good project. I can be integral. I also don't have to move out of London, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't think it has to do with London. I think it has to do with, you know, it reminds me a bit of Virgil van Dijk joining Liverpool rather than Man City, who also wanted to sign him at that time, and also Chelsea. That's kind of what it reminds me of. I think he looks at it and thinks, I could do this. Like, you know, if I can win the Premier League with Arsenal, and if it happens, it's going to be so much bigger than it would be to win the Premier League with Man City.
Mm.
Because Man City have won, it's five of the last six, right?
Yeah.
So they usually win the league. So you'd just be another in these kind of procession of players coming in, and, you know, maybe the Pep would leave you on the bench for 3 months or repurpose you into a left-sided central defender. You know, no, really. I mean, when they were looking at signing him, I thought, well, to be honest, I thought the reason they're doing this is to make Arsenal pay more. That was really what I thought their interest was.
Mm.
I mean, you've seen them do it with Sanchez, with Ronaldo, before they ended up joining Manchester United. With Maguire, even to a certain extent, I think. I mean, you know, did Guardiola really want to buy Maguire? But I think they suggested that they might, which is how Maguire ended up costing 80 million. So, you know, they do have a bit of a record of doing this sort of thing. But ultimately, like, there is a sense there that you would be a kind of a cog in a machine. Like, yeah, you get the medals. You know, it's like, it's like Grealish or whatever. Grealish at the moment, oh, I've got all the medals, you know. It's like, you were much better at Villa. I'm sorry. And that's still true. Even after last season, I know he actually played very well last season. You know, after the World Cup anyway, he, you know, it was the first spell of his City career where he was continuously or very often in the team because Foden kind of got bombed out. And Grealish was in and he was doing well. And he was winning nearly every game and he was playing some good stuff. I think it was still, I just think it's Villa. He was more himself at Villa.
Sure.
Like you can't really be yourself in a Guardiola team. It's not about you. It's about him, right? It's about him. It's about the system. It's about the team. And like, that's fair enough. Like, I mean, he is the best coach. Like he is bigger than any of the players and he has sort of earned that status. But like, there's more to life than, you know, winning trophies for Pep Guardiola.
Sure.
So I think the, you know, to be the opportunity to be a real hero for Arsenal is what has, like, he knows that he goes there, he can become a huge player in this team. Was that opportunity really there at Man City? Maybe, but with Arsenal, it's definitely there for him. He can do it.
Yeah.
They could win the league, and imagine if they did. As opposed to these sort of City things where, you know, it all ends up like Trump's inauguration, where everyone is like, oh, there was loads of people there, you know, and we have loads of fans, you know, this kind of nonsense. Like, if Arsenal were to finally win the league after, what, 21 years it is?
Yeah.
It's 21, 20 years now? 20 years.
20 years. No. It'll be 20 years this year, 2004.
Yeah. I mean, that's longer than the, we've already gone. It's the longest ever Arsenal drought now, right?
I can't remember if it's the longest ever, but certainly in modern times, it was 71 to 89, and then there was 91 and 91 to 90. So, yeah, it is certainly in modern times. I'd have to go back and look at the 30s and 50s and things like that. You know, certainly in the modern era, it is. And, it's overdue. And I think, you know, I do think you're right that there is more – to be gained if you can do it at Arsenal.
It's a challenge. Like, I mean, I'm sure during the first half hour of that game on Sunday, he was like, "Jesus, this is ridiculous. Have we touched the? Have we like this is this what we're supposed to be like?" Mm. You know, but at the end of the day, he won the Community Shield, so he's won trophies in the last two matches.
Quickly on a few of the others. I mean, we talked about Newcastle in abstract terms, but it feels to me maybe that their top four finish last season has them a little bit ahead of schedule. Of course, there's still a few weeks to go in the transfer window and they could do business. How do you think they're going to cope on two fronts again? You know, they're not going to be a surprise package, of course. Next season, everybody kind of knows how Newcastle want to play. They might be a bit better prepared for it at times this season, and then they have to deal with Europe and squad depth, and all those things become a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably need to add some more players, you know, because one thing that Eddie Howe and Jason Tindall like to do is pick a pretty settled team, you know. They had like six of the players, I think, started more than 30 or played more than 30 matches worth of minutes. You know, if you see like the desperation, there were moments that last season when Bruno Guimaraes took a blow to the ankle sort of situation, and it's like, we'll do anything to not have to take this guy off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Limping around all his ankle. That was the kind of a thing that happened a few times last season. But it's like, no, you're staying on. Like there's a kind of, there was a real core of players that played nearly every game for them. And it's difficult to do that when you also have to play the Champions League, which obviously is going to be huge. You know, Newcastle haven't been in since for what, 20 years, I guess. So I think they'll probably need to bring more. I mean, I think Harvey Barnes is a pretty useful player.
Yeah.
They've signed Livermiento. They've signed Sandro Tonali. These are not necessarily spectacular signs. I mean, Livermiento plays in Trippier's position. Trippier was the guy who played more minutes last season than anyone for them in the league. So maybe they're intending to use him somewhere else. I don't know. He's pretty high end cover if that's all he is. Tonali, I suppose, maybe is looking to take some minutes off Sean Longstaff. It doesn't seem like that exciting a signing, but they have, I don't know. I mean, they may not yet be finished. I mean, I'd say that the strange thing from Newcastle's point of view is kind of discovering that maybe they're not the star asset in the Saudi portfolio. You know, it's kind of like, well, hang on a second, you know, maybe they would have expected there to be more, but like, I agree with what you said in terms of they're clearly ahead of schedule. Like that, I certainly did not expect them to get anywhere near the Champions League. I mean, a few things had to happen, you know, the collapse of Chelsea, the collapse of Liverpool, the collapse of Tottenham in the later part of last season.
Oh, yeah,
all of these things kind of came together for them. They just made it in the end. But they did develop a very kind of, they became very solid. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Kind of a solid, like determined, hard to beat sort of pig of a team. Which is good when you're sort of on the up, you know, like a kind of a knife between the teeth, you know, let's go, these guys say we've got the lowest ball in play time in the league. I don't know if you saw that clip of Eddie Howe.
No, no.
They've got a documentary coming out, you know, and this was how Eddie Howe chose to motivate his players ahead of the Man United game. Erik ten Hag has said that we have the lowest ball in play time in the league. Well, if they want a fast game here, let's go ahead and fucking give it to them. So this is how, and in fairness, they did. They ran United off the field that day and won 2-0, I think it was. I think the problem that they have is going to be, the problem they had last season was kind of effectively was scoring more than anything, you know, like defending, they were good. They obviously got this reputation for time wasting, which they didn't like, but which they obviously, it was deliberate, you know, it was
for sure.
Yeah, of course it was. And so there's a bit of, there's a kind of a slightly negative edge to the way they, you know, he didn't go to study at Atletico Madrid with Diego Simeone. He was, he's an admirer of that type of thing. And I don't know if it really, works. I don't know if it's, for a team that's, in the Champions League and aspiring to win the title, which I guess Newcastle now are. I mean, they've got everything going for them. You know, they've got Saudi Arabia, they've got the best fans in the world. They've got, they've got all these great players and the best manager, the best English manager, Eddie Howe. Why not? So he will be confronted with that expectation now. Sure. and how he deals with the situation that he's never been in before will determine his fate, I guess.
Liverpool signed two very good players, but they've lost a lot of experience. And I know there's only so long players can go on, but in one summer they've lost Milner, Henderson, Firmino, Fabinho, Kate has gone, and of course the main man, and like Oxlade-Chamberlain is no longer there. But I mean, they have lost a great deal of experience. And look, teams have to renew and refresh, and I think they've done it pretty well in terms of the two big players that they've brought in. But I mean, Liverpool's success has felt over the years to be based on a pretty good collective situation at that football club with Klopp and sporting directors. And there've just been some departures and things like that, which might make you worry a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, it really does feel like it's falling apart, I think, for Liverpool, like that whatever kind of magic, let's say, was animating the club, in the sense of a kind of a shared belief that the players had that, this is a really good group of players. This manager really knows what he's doing. We love coming into work every day. I feel like that's really just broken now. It's gone. It's dissolved. Like it's the kind of feeling that you get that Arsenal kind of give off now, that kind of sense of
everybody's pulling in the one direction, and
we all believe in what we're doing here. We think that if we, and clearly that wasn't the case last season at Liverpool. And what's happened now this summer, there was a quote from Van Dijk the other day, well, maybe it's just last night after their game, saying, I can understand how people worry when, we a lot of players leave and only two arrive. And yes, I can understand people. I mean, then we concede goals. Yes, I can. These sound like your doubts, Virgil. It sounds like you may share these worries or these doubts. This is like the captain of the team. Maybe it was actually part of him saying, look, this is nothing to worry about. We've got this. But I mean, they go through last season getting repeatedly run off the field. They had that series against Wolves and Brighton where, I mean, Brighton in particular just tore them to shreds, and everyone agreed, okay, this team has sort of lost its legs. It's to some extent, it's kind of a moral collapse, like in the sense of they had that season where, they played like every game you could play, got to the Champions League final, lost the Premier League on the last day, having, chasing all the way, but confirmed they lost on the last day, lost the Champions League in final in a really disappointing way. Klopp was trying to say, all right, lads, he got them all on the bus and it's like, we're going to have a parade anyway, it's like, it's important to remember that our season has, but like clearly they didn't really feel that, they felt like the season, it had been a long chase, which had ended in failure. And I think like that, it kind of fed into what happened. They lost, obviously, Mane, who went on to have a terrible season himself, but was one of their kind of tone-setting players, I think, for that entire period of their success, and he was gone. Brought in Darwin, a turkey, Like, I mean, sometimes team signs a turkey, I mean, Chelsea did it with Lukaku. That's a terrible sign. I mean, with Darwin, maybe...
He's young enough, maybe, to...
He's young enough and he's kind of strong and quick and he's got like these basic, elements, which you could imagine a good player having, Like he's got some basic attributes which are good, but I have not seen anything from him since he's joined Liverpool that suggests that he can be part of a really top team. I think he could be a striker who could score 20 goals in the Premier League. But I think a lot of the time also he's, I don't know if he could be part of a kind of a top team in the sense of, in the way that Firmino was. Firmino, a player who is going to keep the ball, you know, who knows where to pass the ball, who knows when to pass the ball. These are the kind of things that Darwin, I just don't feel, I don't feel he's got them. He's like a runaway horse. You know what I mean? He's a wild horse. And okay, and there's a place for that. And he scored a few goals last season. I know people say, well, he kind of looked a bit, he wasn't great at his first season at Benfica either. And then the next season he exploded. I think the problem he's going to have is how does he get in the team? Because, you know, the Liverpool at the moment, when you look at, say, the Premier League previews and so on, it's like, well, Liverpool have got their midfield woes, but they've got such firepower. And you're like, yeah, but you can still only play three of them, right? You know, you've got Salah, Gakpo, Diaz, Jota, Darwin, right? They're the five forwards and they play with three. So, I mean, in my opinion, the order there goes Salah's number one, then you've got Gakpo, Diaz, and Jota, and then you've got Darwin. He's number five out of five. So how do you get the kind of run against? Like with Benfica, he was in their first team. Don't have a great game 1 week, that's fine. You're going to be in the team next week. You know, you can kind of build up confidence, go on a run, all that kind of stuff. I just don't understand how it's going to happen. You know, how could you put him in the team ahead of Cody Gakpo or Luis Diaz? You'd have to be insane.
Well, Europa League might be his stage.
Maybe. But I feel as though that, and you saw Carragher talking about this the other day, Carragher and Neville having their, you know, Twitter arguments. But Carragher mentioned something, you know, which you hear talked about with Liverpool a lot, which is that really what's happened here is Klopp is kind of running the whole show now. You know, previously he was the coach and they had, you know, Michael Edwards and they had the medical department and they had everything. Whereas now it's like Klopp is kind of looming over everything. And that's not necessarily good.
That sounds like familiar to me. That sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so similar. I feel it's so similar to the story of Arsenal in the second half of Wenger's time. I don't expect anything good really from Liverpool. I mean, they've got a lot of good players, but I feel as though the whole thing has become brittle. I don't think Klopp really has the same charisma that he had before, or I don't think he commands quite the same sense of wow, this guy. You know, I think tactically they've been worked out a little bit. You know, like when I see City the other day or Brighton last season. It's like the whole the sort of pressing storm that Jurgen Klopp's career was sort of built on. You know, this like, oh, we're going to go out there and they're going to think we have 15 players, has carried him this far. But I kind of feel as though football has now evolved past it. It's like all of the current footballers have grown up with that. Like when Klopp was sort of unleashing that at first, a lot of the times they're coming up against players who haven't really encountered it and don't know what to do. Whereas now it's like, it's just normal. You're surprised when the other team doesn't press. You know what I mean? So like this whole idea of, like, I feel as though it's the last evolutionary leap of football. It's the previous one. Yeah. So maybe he'll surprise us by kind of updating things, coming up with some sort of tweak. But like the way Brighton were playing with them last season, they didn't seem to have any ideas as to what to do with it. And yeah, I think it could be a tough season.
All right. I'm cognizant of the fact we've been going a while and I haven't quite got around to as many teams as I would like, but, you know, fuck Spurs and Chelsea and those people. If I could ask you for, like, just off the top of your head, I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but maybe a wild card for the Premier League this season, you know, a team... maybe Brighton again, who might do something that people didn't expect. Newcastle finished top four. Do you think it's possible that that might happen again, that you might get somebody from the outside in that top four? Or is it a case that now that Arsenal are spending, City are spending, Liverpool are spending, you might see something of a return to the traditional top six thereabouts? I mean, Chelsea have bought, I don't know, 50 fucking players since Todd Bowley took over. I don't know how many it is. It's probably way up in the high 20s. Yeah. But they've got now an actual manager rather than Frank Lampard, you know, so that probably stands them in some good stead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with Chelsea, it's really hard to know. Like, I saw that Nkunku, who was their, you know, main, I suppose, striker signing, is going to be out till Christmas, which isn't good. Mm. Although Nicholas Jackson's been doing well in preseason, but again, it's all a bit sort of, it's just, you know, we have to see what their squad looks like.
Yeah.
You know, are they going to have 33 players again? Because if you have 33 players, then it's just very difficult, I think, to... You almost have to just send 11 of those players off to... it's too many. You know, it's just... How can you... A lot of them know that they're not even relevant to the bench, or, you know, there's no chance of them getting anywhere near the team. So what are they even doing here? I think that was a big problem for them last season. They have to be better this season, though. I just can't see it going the same way. I mean, the team you haven't mentioned that I thought you were going to is Villa with Ole Unai.
No, I mean, who've they brought in? Pau Torres is a good signing. They did well last season.
They've got Moussa Diaby. They've got Youri Tielemans.
Yeah. I mean, he's done a very good job there, to be fair. Certainly a club that's more aligned to... I think it's, you know, more of a right place, right time situation for him than it was at Arsenal, where he was, you know, wrong man at the wrong time. But then I think pretty much anybody would have been the wrong man at that time for Arsenal. You know, he does have a tendency to just last a couple of seasons.
Second in the 2023 calendar year table.
The calendar year table. Well, there you go.
Ahead of Man United and Arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that that's your little wild card prediction?
Yeah, well, I mean, it would sort of have to be, because anyone else is like, I mean, is it a wild card to say, oh, I think Liverpool will get back in top four? I think they might struggle again. You know, Man United, are they a wild card? Like,
No, clearly not.
They should be there. Newcastle already were there. Tottenham, I don't really see how they're going to do it from where they are. I mean, you look through the rest of the teams. I mean, and Chelsea are obviously the ones that finished lowest last season, who you would have to consider among the teams who are usually there, obviously.
So the scope for improvement is much bigger for Chelsea because it's a low bar for Chelsea.
And there's such a weird set of circumstances. And it's clear that, like, at some point, a lot of their players just sort of gave up, or, like, just started jockeying for position in terms of transfers and, what's going to happen here? They kind of knew the season. They're not going to get relegated. They're not going to qualify for Europe. There was nothing to play for, so everyone just had sort of lost interest, which isn't going to be the case, you would assume, at the start of the season. I mean, they play Liverpool to begin with, so that's going to be a good tone setter. But, yeah, I think that this is... I think Arsenal and Man City look like the two best teams. I mean, Man City look like the best team. I'm just reading out the table from last season, really. but that is still how I see it. Like, I don't feel as though Manchester United have done enough to kind of really close the gap, or that Liverpool have repaired themselves properly, or that Brighton are, you know, Brighton may lose Caicedo to Chelsea. I mean, that he would be a massive signing for Chelsea, I think, and a huge loss to Brighton, who've obviously already lost McAllister. And Newcastle maybe would be a little bit better, but I think they could be a little bit better and still be a little marginal for Champions League. So, where did I start with this? Aston Villa. Yeah.
All right.
go Villa. Everything will just continue the same as it was earlier in 2023.
All right. Well, look, we will see how it plays out. And as ever, it's a pleasure chatting to you and listening to you throughout the season on Second Captains. We'll leave it there for now. Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good to talk to you.
Thank you as ever to Ken. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Ken Earlys, at Ken Earlys, and of course over on Second Captains. And you can get more details of what they do, their Patreon, etc., etc., at secondcaptains.com. Right, let's leave it there for this one. As I said, there is another podcast available for you right now if you haven't already listened to it. If you have already listened to it, we'll have a preview podcast for you on Patreon looking ahead to the Nottingham Forest game. That will be available for you Friday afternoon. For now, let's leave it there, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.